What's going on, everybody? Everybody got me? Stevie, what's up, buddy?
Been not much. Long, man. You got a tan or something? You have a red head.
Yeah, no, I've been canoeing for the last 4 days.
How was that?
Incredible. Truly incredible. Off grid, no tech, no reception, just like a fire and my family.
Amazing.
And Andrew's got his hair down today, man. I haven't seen you do that in a long time. Digging it, man. Digging it.
It's hot here.
Does that mean you put it down? I thought you put it up when it's hot.
Except when I'm sweaty at jiu-jitsu, I gotta take a full shower so the hair gets washed.
Nice. Stevie. All right, everybody. Well, happy Wednesday. Looks like we had a pretty small group. We got some new faces on here. David, I haven't seen you on here before. I don't think. Are you pretty new?
Sir, how are you? I've been on one call before.
Nice. I've been away for a couple weeks, so thanks for being here. Where are you, David? Where are you in the world?
I'm in Utah.
Nice. I think we got some feedback. Utah. Awesome, man. I love Utah. All right, guys. So I thought I'd make today about training. I've been writing a coach's certification on training, and spent the last better part of the last couple of weeks writing on a certification. We're relaunching a muscle intelligence certification, which we haven't done in years. We're going to go big. We're going to go hard. It's going to be fun. We're going to train a lot of the coaches around the world on our style, on our methods. So I thought I'd bring some of that information to this call and give you guys some insights into really how I think about programming. How ultimately us as coaches select exercises, how we select sets, reps, volume, load to ultimately be maximally effective. And I think some really simple things apply to everyone. It doesn't just need to apply to coaches. It can apply to you. And understanding how to make the most of your workout is ultimately what this is about. And it's important to acknowledge that everyone is at a different place in their journey. And it's really important for you to not look outside of yourself for a model, right? I'll explain what that means. Sometimes we look for people that we want to emulate and we say, hey, I want to do what that person, I want to look like them. So therefore I should do what they do. And you guys know that doesn't make any sense. We hope you know that doesn't make any sense because you're not at the same level they are. So for us as coaches, one of the most important prerequisites is being able to assess and identify where you are now. And what the biggest opportunities are, we call them levers, right? So what are the biggest opportunities for you to progress right now to make the greatest amount of progress with the least amount of work? Because ultimately the goal is not the maximum amount of work. The goal is like, what can my body tolerate? So it's not just like go and put the gas pedal all the way down and go as fast as I possibly can. While that is sometimes promoted, it doesn't make a lot of sense. If you don't have the ability to recover, then the training is ineffective, right? So you guys have to think about, we have to match our recoverability. What is my body capable of recovering from right now with what I'm actually subjecting it to? Is everybody with me so far? Yeah. Okay. So doing a workout that is far beyond your recovery capacity does not benefit you, right? It may benefit your psychological resilience. It may make you feel strong. It may make you feel tough. But ultimately, if you're looking for the body to adapt, you have to ensure that your body is capable of adapting to the imposed demand. Right. So we go in the gym, we're going to impose a demand on our body, on our muscular system, on our skeletal system, on our nervous system, on our cardiovascular system. And we have to say, okay, does my body have the ability to adapt to this imposed demand? If it doesn't, you're wasting your time. So then how do we, as coaches, start to assess where you are in this moment and what the biggest opportunities are for you? And so the way I think about exercise from a foundational level, right? So let's start at the bottom. We'll build our way up to the top. At the foundational level, what I'm looking for is I need you to move without restriction or limitation, right? That's the base of it all, right? And we call it quality movement. What is your physical capability? What is your physical capacity to move? Start there. And so we start, within muscle intelligence, we start with about 8 to 10 exercises and we go, these are the ones that you foundationally need to be well suited or well highly capable of executing with a high degree of competency. So everything we program in the first couple of weeks or months is going to be with the intention of moving you in the direction of those 8 to 10 exercises being executed with what we'll call mastery. That's a really small number of exercises. And some people go, that's it. That's all I need to do. And the answer is, if you don't do those well, everything you do on top of that will also be performed ineffectively or ultimately be ineffective in getting you the results. Does that make sense? So it doesn't mean you're only going to do those 8 to 10 exercises, but what it means is everything that we do in addition to that should have the benefit of contributing to making those exercises better. As an example, many people, let's say 8 out of 10, don't use their glutes very well when they squat. So we may, you know, if you think of this like isolation and integration, right? So an integrated exercise is a squat. I'm using my quads, I'm using my glutes, I'm using my spinal erectors. I'm using a lot of different muscles. And that's an integrated sum of its parts. If I extract a muscle group like the glutes and I say, well, I need to isolate these glutes to make them more effective in isolation so that when I reintegrate them into the system, they're going to be more effective at doing their job. That's how we may include other exercises to help you be more effective in your training. Everybody with me so far? Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. So that's a really important framing. So we're looking at you, and this is a really, I'll make it one more important point. When we look at exercise, or I'll say this about myself, when I look at exercise, I look at it in a very different way than most people do. And our coaches are the same as well, but like, I can't speak for everybody when I say this, but when I look at people move, I'm looking at such nuanced minutia, like such little things happening at the foot, at the knee, at the ankle, at the hip, all these different little like nuance, even at your breath pattern, your orientation of your rib cage, your orientation of your head, your orientation of your eyes. All this is just giving me so much information as to what your body is doing to make this exercise look and feel right to you. So when you're doing a bench press, you may just be watching the bar go from your chest to full extension, where I may be watching what you're doing with your left glute and your right foot. And while we start seeing things like that, lay patterns of going, okay, this person, let's say Dave, is having a hard time stabilizing his right glute. Therefore, there's some instability happening there. We have to address that to make his bench press better. I'm like, what? Yes. So the body is a sum of its parts, right? An integrated sum of its parts. And so for us as coaches, to make you really effective at what you do, we're looking at all the little things that ultimately contribute to this big picture body. So when I look at your body, you guys may be going, man, I just want to build my pecs, or I just want to have big arms. And we're going, yeah, no problem. Here's what I'm getting to. There's one desired end state that we should all work to begin with, and it's called structural balance, right? So if I was to stand up and have no resistance against my body, and I just stand with my palms, palms are down facing toward you, in this what's called the anatomical position, I want my rib cage and my pelvis to be stacked on top of each other. If you look at me from the side, my ear, my shoulder, my hip, my knee, and my ankle are all vertically aligned, not one forward or back. They're all vertically aligned. My shoulders sit comfortably. I'm not slouched forward or pulled back. They're in this position that's called scaption, which is ultimately having the rib cage or the scapula sit comfortably against the rib cage. And I need to sit in that position and maintain that position of structural balance in everything I do. Why? Structural balance is this position of least resistance, path of least resistance in the body. It's where the skeleton is stacked or as close to stacked as we can. That's the most efficient or most effective starting position for everything we do. As soon as we divert any joint or any muscle away from this structural balance, can you guys all picture structural balance in your mind? It's like just like a body standing there in space looking straight ahead and everything's lined. If I removed all my muscles, the skeletal system would still stand up straight, right? It's like what you see, this like the skeleton and the head on a skeleton. It's vertically aligned. And that ultimately is a desired position for us all to start in. Here's the problem. How many of us actually start in a position of optimal structural balance from day one or day zero? Not a lot. Why not? Because we sit too much as a culture. So as soon as you introduce sitting into your life as a child, what happens to your postural muscles? They become lazy. What happens to you when you're sitting? What does everyone do when they're sitting? They slouch. So what do you do to your thoracolumbar cavity? You know, the space between your lower ribs and your upper pelvis. So what did I just do to my rib cage? Or sorry, what did I just do to my diaphragm? I restricted its ability to move, right? So the first thing that goes, if I'm trying to move towards structural balance, the first thing I want to address is, do I have space to breathe correctly, right? Breathing correctly into the entire thorax is the foundation of every single thing you do in your day. Foundation of walking, foundation of breathing, foundation of squatting, the foundation of lunging, bench pressing, all of it is the same. The most functional thing we do as humans is breathe every day. We breathe on average 20 to 22,000 times a day. If all of them are dysfunctional, everything you do on top of that is also dysfunctional. So every one of us should become intentional with our breathing practice. Doesn't mean you need to be doing Wim Hof breathing. Doesn't mean you need to be doing meditation. Just means like, let's all just sit up straight right now and take a breath together. And what I want you to do as we breathe, I want you to think about if your rib cage and your thorax, let's call it your abdominal region, your abdomen, is a balloon, and you have to blow it up. And I want you to inhale and blow it up. But here's the catch. I want you to feel it in your sides and your back. So if I was there with my two thumbs right at the base of your rib cage in the back, kind of between your pelvis and the rib cage right there, jamming my two thumbs in there, I want you to push that out. So when you're breathing, I want you to feel like you're breathing into your back. Everybody go. Hold. Let it out slowly as you can. Do it one more time. Don't let your chest and shoulders move. Just breathe into your belly. Breathe into your back. Pause. Let it out as slowly as you can. Now, if anyone in this community, has anyone ever heard of Ujjayi breath? They never taken a yoga class to learn Ujjayi breath. Okay, this is probably one of the most, if not the most important thing you're going to ever learn when it comes to breathing. So you get all these people out there teaching breath work. Nobody's ever taught this, or at least nobody I've ever heard, like modern day, teaches this stuff. Ujjayi breath is when you breathe through the back of your throat, and it's kind of restricting the back of your throat. So you feel it right here. So it sounds like Darth Vader, right? So if I were to go and have a mirror in front of my face and I go, that's what I'm doing, but it's with your mouth closed. Listen. Try that. So it's not, it's through here. And it takes a little, it's easier to do it on the exhale than it is to do it on the inhale. So everybody do their best impression of Darth Vader. And you'll notice if you do that, you can actually exhale a little bit longer. Just try again. Try it on the inhale now. You'll notice if you do that, your diaphragm fills up more effectively. Did anybody notice? Did anybody have a hard time with it? Anybody was like, nah, I can't do this. It feels the same as the other way. Feel free to, guys, I'm here to help. So in my opinion, this is probably the most important single foundational step in learning how to breathe effectively. One, for performance breathing, which we call, you know, the ability to perform more effectively in the gym. But two, just to be able to breathe more effectively into your diaphragm. So why do we want to breathe into our diaphragm? Diaphragm is, listen to this, quote of the day. Diaphragm is the most important muscle in the body. Why? Structural balance. It's balancing out your spine. If you have back pain, shoulder pain, or hip pain, I guarantee your diaphragm is weak. 98% of the time, maybe 100% of the time. Right? So if you're someone who wants to wake up in the morning without back pain, breathe. Breathe deeply. When someone wants to wake up without shoulder pain, breathe deeply. hip pain, breathe deeply. And now, so breathing deeply has two ends, right? It has the inhalation and then the exhalation. So a deep inhale is only one half of it. The other half is full exhalation. Everybody try this with me. I want you to get a full exhalation. Now, here's the thing. Full exhalation is incredibly uncomfortable. It feels like you're really wanting to breathe in. Watch. Still going. So really trying to get even that last little bit of air out. Here's why. In order for me to effectively use my diaphragm, I also want to relax my diaphragm, right? So some people have what we call an inhale strategy. Some people have what we call an exhale strategy. We don't tell you what that means, but ultimately some people spend a lot of time at the top of the inhale. Some people spend a lot of time at the bottom of the exhale. You want to learn how to train both. Think of it like a range of motion. Hey, little man. Think of it like a range of motion, like you're curling your bicep, right? The breath is no different. How can you increase that range of motion to fully expand the space between the rib cage and the intercostals, to fully expire your air and fully relax the diaphragm? When you relax the diaphragm, it comes up under the rib cage, allows the pelvic floor to activate. Yes. So this is incredibly important as a foundation to everything we do as humans, not as just high performance athletes. Right? I consider every one of you guys a high-performance athlete. I hope you do too. Our objective is to treat you like gold medal winning athletes, right? Treat yourself like an athlete. What would an athlete do? What does the gold medal winning version of myself do each day, right? Not silver, not bronze, gold medal. There's a difference. Person who wins gold always falls through. There's no question of whether or not they're going to fall through, is there? They just execute. And this is why we say we train champions. Gold medal winning athletes find a way to succeed. They always follow through on their commitments. So one of the things that I say as a foundation to everything we do in training is breath work. I'll pause right there for any questions. What questions do you guys have about breathing, specifically about mechanics of breathing? If you have any questions about CO2 or anything like that, I can answer that as well.
When you're exhaling like that fully, really forcing all the air out, I'm assuming you're not doing that just like all the time at rest. That's more of like a practice sort of thing.
Correct. Yep. Great question. So breathing at rest should be as little as possible. So Patrick McEwen, who I think is certainly one of the top three experts in the world in breath work, says you should breathe so softly that you don't disturb your nose hairs. That's the goal. So if I was just to breathe, so he calls it low and slow, right? So like, just don't disturb the nose hairs. And it's like 3 seconds in, pause, 3 seconds out, pause. Overbreathing is probably the number one, I don't think it's a cause, but I think it's a symptom of dysfunction. So I think it's one of these, like, that's the light on the dashboard. So people breathe fast, they overbreathe, they can hear them when they breathe heavy. This is a symptom. This is a light on the dashboard of like, hey man, something's very wrong with your body, with your metabolism. And so important, at the foundation of every single thing we do is metabolism, right? Because what is metabolism? It's the ability to take the food we consume, combine it with the oxygen we breathe, and produce energy to live. It's not just energy to move, it's energy to think, it's energy to produce hormones, it's energy to transcribe DNA. Everything in the body, everything in the known universe requires ATP. Okay. So if our metabolism, our ability to produce energy is ineffective, the way you will know it's ineffective is by the way you're breathing as a foundation, right? You'll seldom find someone who can breathe really well and has an ineffective metabolism. And the opposite is obviously true. If someone's breathing poorly, you can assume probably 100 times out of 100 that their metabolism is dysfunctional. Okay, so here's a breathing test for you. Has anyone ever heard of a CO2 tolerance test? Carbon dioxide tolerance. Simply, there's two ways to do it. I don't know that there's any difference. One's from Brian McKenzie, one's from Patrick McEwen. Brian McKenzie says, breathe in as much as you possibly can, all the way in, all the way in, all the way in, fill yourself up. Stop, start the clock, exhale as long as you possibly can. and time it. That time should be 60 seconds and beyond for having a decent CO2 tolerance. Patrick McEwen, the other guy, says, breathe normally. No forced inhale, no forced exhale, breathe normally. After a normal inhale, start exhaling. No, wait. No, yeah. After a normal inhale, exhale normally. Don't force exhale. At the end of your exhale, pause, hold your breath, hit a stopwatch, and hold your breath. And so your ability to hold your breath after an exhale is another way to test your CO2 tolerance. That one, I believe, should be 40 seconds plus of a breath hold to have a somewhat acceptable CO2 tolerance. So it's basically just checking your ability to control your breathing. That help, Jeff? Sweet. What questions have you, ladies and gentlemen? Okay. If no one else has questions, I'm going to move on. So when I speak of these 8 to 10 exercises, and there's 8, but the 2 additional ones are breathing and walking, right? So breathing and walking have to be in everyone's life and everyone's program, and you should be doing it effectively. We don't spend huge amounts of time teaching breathing because it's very nuanced. It's very, very nuanced. Like this, you know, we do these calls probably every 3 months where we'll teach breathing because it's so important. And I should shoot some videos soon, and I will actually shoot some videos soon and to teach you guys how to breathe most effectively. But the key is just learning how to use your diaphragm. Like if you can figure out how to do that Ujjayi breath and then breathe into deeply into your diaphragm, you're gold. So I'll give you guys a goal. When I was doing my breathwork daily, my expansive breathwork daily, training at a high level, I won't say at my peak, but at a high level, I was doing 60 to 70 second inhales, 60 to 70 second exhales. That was like peak capacity, which is very high. And that's just really learning how to relax all of the muscles of the thorax. So think of breathing in and filling up a balloon. At some point, you're like, man, I got 15 seconds and I feel like I'm full. Yeah, because all those muscles are so tense that envelop your rib cage and your thorax that they won't relax and expand. So think of all the muscles that live between the rib cage. Those are called your intercostal muscles. Those muscles attach onto the spine. And so if those muscles aren't moving well, guess what happens to your rib cage and your spine? It becomes very rigid. So if I can expand those muscles, allow them to really expand in all directions, all of a sudden my spine moves more effectively. Well, guess what happens if your spine moves more effectively? Your shoulders move more effectively. Your neck moves more effectively. Your jaw moves more effectively. Right? And you get blood flow and cerebral spinal fluid flow more effectively to your brain, right? You guys want to improve your overall performance, create a breathwork practice. You don't even need 10 minutes a day, right? Maybe in the beginning it's 10 minutes. Maybe after a while it's a little bit less, but it's not huge amounts. It's just consistency, like everything in life, isn't it? Okay. So if now we've learned how to use our diaphragm, our spine is moving really well, what just happened to our squats, deadlifts, lunges, and bench press? If we just did that as a foundation, let's say we spent 1 month, we just really improved everyone's breathing mechanics. What happened to our squat, deadlift, lunges, pull-ups, bench press, overhead press? It gets exponentially better. Why? Because the prerequisite to all muscle building is stability. So there's mobility and stability. So I always say 3 things, right? Mobility, stability, and skill. Those are the prerequisites to everything we do as athletes. I have to have the prerequisite mobility to get into the position. I have to have the stability to not move in that position. I need to have the skill to coordinate multiple muscles over a range of motion. Mobility, stability, skill. So if I can simply improve my ability to move and control my thorax, which is ultimately my spine, rib cage, and abdomen, then everything I do on top of that gets better. When you put a bar on your back to squat, the reason you can't squat more has nothing to do with your leg drive. It has to do with your ability to stabilize your spine. So the distance between your spine and your pelvis, the distance between the bar that's being applied on your back and your pelvis is where the body breaks for most people. Most people don't have the spinal control and spinal stability to be able to squat heavier and therefore distribute the load that they're putting on their back with a squat bar through their legs. Your back, and same with deadlifts, your back and the spine needs to be unbendable. It needs to be so rigid that it doesn't move, right? And if it moves, then you're going to hurt yourself. Or if it moves, you're not going to be able to move the weight. It's going to collapse. You're going to collapse your thorax. You're going to collapse your diaphragm, not be able to breathe effectively. If you can't breathe effectively, you can't get energy to the working muscles. If you can't get energy to the working muscles, stuff stops, right? So how many of you right now, if you put 500 pounds on your back, you go, whoo, right? Like crunch down. Everyone except for Steve and Johnny, maybe Andrew, right? We would all collapse under it, right? And so again, 500 pounds is obviously an extreme example, but the more you can withstand that compressive force put on your back and still maintain that spinal stability and structure, the more effective you can be at loading everything. Because as soon as I go into this position where that's my spine and I'm going into this rounded position, everything I do on top of that is dysfunctional. So our job as coaches is to make you really good at two things. Well, maybe more, but two primary things in this case. One, accessing the range of motion. So being able to get into position to contract muscles. And two, increasing over time your ability to not move in that position. Right? So getting into the position, which is moving there. And second, the ability to not move. So what do we call? I call that rigidity, the ability to not move, and fluidity, right? So the same as mobility and stability, but maybe a different way to think of it is rigidity. Like your ability to be rigid in position and not move is incredibly important to your ability to build muscle. And the ability to be fluid, the ability to move there. Does that make sense? Everybody with me? So this is how we start framing, okay, where does Jeff move really well? Where does he have the fluidity, the prerequisite fluidity to access these ranges of motion that he ultimately wants to do, or we want him to do to get the physical change he wants? And where does he not have the rigidity and fluidity? And that's how I then build an exercise program. And we start with selecting the right exercises to challenge muscles in specific positions. Then we say, okay, if I've at the foundation of everything, select the right exercises for you. Then we go, okay, based on the exercises selected, what proportion need to come from exercises that are ultimately going to contribute to me getting better at these basic eight, and which ones are ultimately going to be the basic eight? Does that make sense? So some of you may have started in a foundational program, which is building up those basic eight, right? What we call the big eight. And if you're not really effective at those, you should spend every day for the next unlimited amount of time to perfect those, or to come as close to you can as well to what we call mastery, right? Because if you can master those, they have, the reason I chose those as the big eight is because they have the greatest amount of cross transfer into everything else you do. If you can lunge and squat well, I guarantee you every exercise you do for legs will be exceptional. I guarantee it. If you can deadlift well and stiff like a deadlift well, I guarantee every exercise you do for back will be more effective. Won't be perfect, but it'll be more effective. If you can overhead press effectively, I guarantee your back grows better, your chest grows better, and your shoulders grow better. I guarantee it, right? So people start getting complex and confusing within training when making training decisions, but really it should be simplified. And hopefully this model for you guys is a really simple and effective model. Okay, so now we're just touching on how to build an effective base, right? We're down here at the base of the pyramid. We're going, okay, can you do all of these things? And I rate them at a five. Can you do each of these eight exercises at least a 4 out of 5 or a 5 out of 5? If you can't, the goal is to get there, okay? And so if you can, then now and only now do we start considering deeper levels of programming, which is undulation and all these 30,000 different programming models that can effectively help you progress without plateaus. And for anyone who ever has had a plateau, plateaus aren't a real thing, right? There's no such thing as a plateau. It's just ineffective programming. So if you're reaching plateaus, or if you feel like you've reached a plateau, the time is now to address it. because there's no such thing as plateaus. There's way too many variables to be able to progress at a single point in time to ever be limited by anything, right? You may just be like, oh, my bench press is at 225 or 315. Great. Stay there for, put the bench press on pause for a little bit, train something else that at the same time, even though you're not doing the bench press, makes the bench press better, right? So plateaus are absolutely a thing of the past, right? Those are like 1970s Weider principle type things. Plateaus shouldn't exist in our reality. Any questions to this point? Andrew, what you got to add, man? I see you back there. I know you got something good to add.
Just laughing, to be honest. I was going to put in the chat that they're fake news. Something I feel like a question for maybe some people, because I feel like it's definitely common, is shoulder range of motion. People that are possibly, I know a good handful, even currently, a handful of my clients that are a little bit kyphotic, a little bit anterior, and just trying to articulate. And Ben, you and I have had conversations about this as far as what is a fair expectation in people's mindset. Obviously on the coach, it's on them to select the correct exercise and the correct movements to improve that. But what is a fair strategy if someone clearly has a hard time pressing overhead as far as time allotted?
Great question, man. So I'll tell you guys, the two biggest culprits for injuries that we see, at least that I see, are kyphotic spine, which is what Andrew said, and I'll explain what that is for those of you who don't know, and weak dysfunctional feet. And so I could guarantee that of the 23 people that are on this call, 22 of you probably have dysfunctional feet, or maybe 20 of you probably have dysfunctional feet. And dysfunctional simply means weak, right? So muscles so the muscles of your feet are meant to be shock absorbers. And so if your feet aren't working as shock absorbers because you're put into shoes at the time you're two, your feet aren't going to work properly, which throws off your hips, which throws off your spine, which throws off your shoulders, and everywhere up the chain. The other most common cause of injuries, this is what Andrew's saying, is the spine that I mentioned earlier is a result of a culture that sits in chairs that are very comfortable but horrible for function. And so if we sit in a chair and our posture just melts away because there's no reason to use posture, think of how many of you guys right now could sit on the floor without a backrest and just simply sit on the floor for an hour while you watch television and have a straight spine? Could you do it? Yeah. And if you can't, you're weak. And if you can't, you're moving toward injury. That's a true, honest statement. And so simply being able to sit on the floor with your legs straight or your legs crossed should be a prerequisite to the human body. Right. If you can't sit on the floor with your spine straight, you are moving in the direction of a shoulder injury, of a spine injury, of a neck injury, and you're probably not allowing your brain to work well. You're probably having problems with sleep and snoring. All these things are downstream negative effects of this kyphotic spine that Andrew's talking about. So kyphotic spine is literally this, right? Leading forward. So as soon as my spine does this, and why does that happen? Remember I said the rib cage, the thorax, it's a space between my ribs and my pelvis. Contracts. So now my diaphragm is constricted, my spine rolls forward, my shoulders roll up and forward, and I kind of sit like this. Anyone ever seen someone like this before? 80% of our male population in the world. Yeah. Well, certainly anyone that's overweight or sits too much. So the first thing we have to start doing to unwind it is, well, okay, let's say this. Andrew asked a specific question. Why does it lead to shoulder injuries and limitations of pressing overhead? Well, if I'm rounded here, my shoulders are forward, try pressing overhead, you can't. So I need to unlock the spine, allow the rib cage to come down, and then I can put my hand above my head. And the first step always is the spine. So I don't care how mobile your shoulder is or your scapula it can be, but it literally can't do what it needs to do without first mobilizing the spine, thoracic spine. So we need to be able to mobilize that. How do we mobilize the thoracic spine most effectively? Breathing, deep breathing by far, right? You could do some expansion things to the thoracic spine, but breathing increases the space between the intercostals, opens up the thoracic spine, allows you then to get the hand above the head. So if the scapula can't sit down the rib cage because it's rolled forward or it's weak, the muscles that move it are weak, you're always going to have shoulder injuries. The number one thing you can do to improve your shoulder problems, breathe deeply. 100% effective, I would say, if you're doing it well. That answer that, Andrew?
Yeah, Stevie? Thanks.
Yeah, man. Stevie, anything you want to add or contribute or ask?
This whole conversation has been great today because I actually had a client that she wants to compete. It's this lady I've been working with for a couple of years, and it's really cool that she actually wants to do this. So she's all jammed up because she's a power lifter. And so she just has never been challenged to work on her mobility. And so this is really cool because in order to get, like, she's been starting to experiment with poses. And so she's not only seen that she can't access these ranges, but now that she's getting into these positions, she's like, well, how do I do that? I'm like, you got to learn how to breathe. That was what we talked about today. Cause like, we just had to get into that because that was how everything else is going to like fundamentally change. Right. It's just really cool that you're talking about everything. Even the first thing you said about the recoverability, which is right on point. Cause we had that same conversation because when you dig into calories, right, like what's the next thought? And everybody thinks, probably a lot of people on this call right now think that they can go to the gym and they can build muscle in the gym, but they're not really understanding that they're there for the stimulus. Right. And that stimulus is therefore taken after, like, in the next, you know, in the next, the time period after the gym, not in the gym. And so I was talking to her about all this stuff, and it's just, it's really well timed. That's all.
Sweet. So Steve brought something up that's interesting. And if you guys are taking notes, this would be something I'd write down. So I created this equation for effective exercise. And I was like, well, people don't think of exercise in terms of this, but there's three parts to effective exercise. There's the exercise stimulus, which is an external stimulus, right? So the external stimulus is the forces being applied against my body. So exercise is just external forces being applied against my body. So if someone comes up from beside me and pushes me, say they push me from here, I'm rotating this way. If I stop them, everything on this side of my body is going to contract, right? So there's external stimulus or external signal, which is ultimately just forces that creates an internal response, right? So there's an external force being applied against the body. Then there's an internal response to that exercise. You still haven't got the result yet. Then the next part of the equation is, so it's external stimulus plus internal response plus adaptation equals results or equals progress, right? So there's three parts of the equation. None of them can be missed. So if we don't have the external signal and the internal adaptation, and remember that the variability in the external signal is real. There can be, you know, 3 sets of 3 is very different than 3 sets of 10, which is very different than 5 sets of 20. Right. And, you know, if you vary with 5 minutes rest and 2 minutes rest and 30 seconds rest, those are creating a different internal response, right? So a different system is being stimulated in a different way. And then the third piece is the adaptation piece. And the adaptation piece is dependent on your recoverability index, right? Your adaptive capacity. What capacity do you have to adapt? And that's, am I sleeping well? Are my cells healthy? Are my hormones optimized? Is my digestion optimized? Am I extracting the nutrients from the food I eat? It's not just what you eat. It's not just like, hey, go take some creatine. There's a whole number of systems that are going to be influencing your ability to adapt to the imposed demand, right? So there's three parts of the exercise equation. External signal, internal response, adaptation equals results, right? Anyone have questions about that? Steve, great thing to bring up, man. Thank you.
Yeah. And, if you have any other ways that, like, you can also bring that up in terms of, like, I do think that a lot of people think, you know, cause we're men, right? We like to think that we can conquer the world. And so I think that a lot of guys do think that they can go into the gym and they can prove the world wrong by not eating enough and then just working harder than the next guy.
Yeah.
I think that that's an important point to drive home for a lot of people. Cause I know I did it. And then I that's why I hurt my back. Like, I know. Yeah. And then now that I'm doing things differently, it's like, it's a crazy world, right?
Well, I'll tell you, man, I'll give you me as an example, right? So by all accounts, I'm probably more advanced than most people, right? I'm more advanced in my understanding of training. I'm more advanced in my physical capability. I'm more advanced in my understanding of recovery, my supplementation, my hormone optimization. I'm probably in the top 1% of people you ever meet in your life. And over the last 2 years, I've deprioritized training or at least deprioritized muscle building. Because I have other goals, and mobility goals, athletic goals, business goals, family goals. And so training is no longer my number one priority. I'm still training at least 3 times a week, usually 4, but I don't really I don't really take advantage of the post-workout window. I don't really take pre-workout supplements. I don't really take protein shakes. I'm trying to eat all naturally. Like, I don't take any supplements. I take a few like vitamin supplements that are for health. But even me taking my foot off the accelerator the way I have, and still knowing my training is really great. My nutrition is very, very good. I probably undereat most of the time. Sometimes I'll compensate for that, but usually I undereat. My results, I've absolutely regressed in the last 2 years. Absolutely regressed in the last 2 years. And so I was like, man, if I would have done this amount of work at the same level of intensity in my 30s, it would have been completely different. I didn't regress at all from 35 to 40, right? I would train for 4 weeks and I'd be back up to 270 pounds. And it was very quick, right? So now I'm finding that I have to actually be like, I can't let things slide as much, even me, right? And so and this is why I have so much passion for helping guys over 40s, because shit starts to change. Legitimate things change. And so we have to start paying attention to, okay, where can I cut corners? Where can I not cut corners? Because I get life gets in the way, man. Sometimes you're like, I can't get everything in every day. No problem. Where should we not cut corners? So I guess speaking to that question, it's just important to realize, guys, that like you need to do your best to optimize all levels of the recoverability / training equation, because if you're not, you're going to regress. Like it's not a question of if you're going to regress or not, if you don't pay attention to and diligently take action on your body, right? You got to be doing things right. Otherwise you're going to regress. And I think all of us are trying to hold off, Mother Nature and Father Time.
Ben, unless it's like a really, really severe case where somebody is dealing with like really, really poor health, in which case just exercise will help increase overall health metrics. Would it be fair to say that if people don't take advantage of, you know, food, sleep and all this kind of stuff, that it almost would be not beneficial at all to work out? If their health is fine. In the sense of like their health is fine, but they're just eating like in a caloric deficit or just, you know, yo-yo dieting, not sleeping 5 hours a night.
Well, no, I think it's always going to be beneficial to work out. I just think that you'll be able to recover from much less, in which case doing too much working out will become a negative stress, right? So we have eustress and distress, positive stress, negative stress. And if your recovery index is incredibly low, your adaptive capacity is incredibly low, then so a really simple way to think about it, if you guys have measured heart rate variability, if your HRV is low, it's really just an indication of your body is going to have a really hard time recovering from whatever you subject it to. And so if you subject yourself to 3 days of hard workouts when your HRV is low, your body simply isn't going to have the ability to recover from it. So the workout itself, I don't think it's going to necessarily have a negative effect. I just don't think you're going to receive any positive benefit from it. What you may get on the other side, I think what you're asking, Steve, is like, you may get increased inflammation. You may get increased sympathetic arousal, which leads to digestive problems and stress and poor sleep. So you could create a spiral into some negative effects. But I think the workout itself will never be negative. But this is also where I think it's important that guys start to realize that you have to learn your body. You have to learn what feels good. You have to learn when to push, when not to push. And it's very subjective, right? Like as a man in our current social media culture, it's like, you got to go in there and crush it every day. And if you do that, you're going to fail. Like it doesn't work when it comes to training, unless you're hormoning the shit out of yourself, eating your face off every day and sleeping, you know, 10 hours a night. It just doesn't work, right? Trust me, been there. I chose the first one, like hormoning the shit out of myself, which is not a good idea for anyone. But that was my path. I was like, I just want to work as hard as I possibly can. And I'm going to take as many hormones as I need to make sure that I adapt. That was my logic in my early 20s. Stupid, but I didn't know any better. I didn't have anyone better to be like, hey man, that's really dumb. Do this instead. There was nobody, right? I was carving my own path. I was like out there bushwhacking with you know, a big machete. I was like, figure this shit out yourself, because there's nobody out there who's going to teach you. Which is why we do what we do. Don't do dumb shit. That should be our motto. anyone else have questions? Johnny, anything to contribute? Chris, go ahead, man.
I was going to say, Ben, in reference to what you said about learn your own body, I completely agree with that. I think it's a great thing to focus on and remember to continue focusing on. Because so often I think we forget that. But also learn your own mind. Learn what typically we tend to neglect or typical patterns we get into mentally. So I think if we're aware of those things, we can catch ourselves in these plateaus, like you said, Ben, that don't exist. So I think learning how your mind works, accepting it, doing what you can to change it, but also just kind of learning your own patterns is hugely important to continuing the success that we're working on.
Yeah, man. That's where the nuance exists, because some people have a cognitive tendency to do too much. Some people have a cognitive tendency to rationalize why they don't need to do anything. And some people just have a cognitive tendency to do nothing. So it's not anyone on this call, but you got to understand yourself. And that, it can be a very challenging thing based on personality tendencies, right? Like, I'm going to guess a lot of us rationalize some stuff once in a while. Like, okay, it's okay. It's okay to not do this. And then you rationalize for a few days and all of a sudden you've taken three steps backwards. So, Chris, are you still able to chat, man, with your, I think you got your baby there.
Hey, what's up, Ben? Yeah, I should be good to go. I think she's ready to eat, but just something I wanted to comment on. You mentioned, I had a question a couple months ago about there potentially being an inverse relationship between like mobility, functionality, and like linear lifts in the route of gaining size, hypertrophy training. And you mentioned a few minutes ago about backing off of the way you used to train in order to pursue more mobility training as one of the things. So my question is, how do you find that balance of, again, if your goal, so my goal right now is gaining size and hypertrophy training. So how do you find that balance of like not mobilizing too much, spending more time with mobility? Is it essentially a proper warm-up that you're doing before you get into this style of hypertrophy training? And I'm asking because for you to put more focus on mobility now versus the amount of focus that you put on it before, I'm wondering if it just was, was it not a priority then?
So here's a good question. I think I know where you're going. So I think I know where you're going. The crazy thing is when I was big, I was incredibly mobile because I had so much end range control. My end range control was obscene compared to most people. Even me now, I'd say my mobility was actually better when I was a bodybuilder. So other than my spine, so I think my thoracic spine was horribly immobile, but everything else was like my hips were very mobile. My shoulders were very more mobile. Everything was very mobile. My ankles were great. And so where I think that fine line, that nuance exists, Chris, is you don't want too much mobility for sure. So just summarizing what Chris is asking, if you're trying to get strong, stretching and mobilizing too much is absolutely counterproductive. But here's where I would nuance your way through this, man. I know you're a smart guy. You'll get this. Stretching is almost never a good idea, in my opinion. I think it feels good. And I think if there's value in blood, there's value in blood flow. But really the whole objective is not just to mobilize or improve flexibility. The objective is how do I get stronger in these end ranges, right? So I don't want to increase my ability to go into a position and not increase my ability to stabilize in that position. So I think, Chris, what you're looking for is very nuanced from a perspective of, look at your body and first go, well, do I have the closest thing that I know how to achieve to structural balance? Meaning there's no kyphotic curves, there's no rotations, because you have that, because any of those are going to cause roadblocks. So the first thing you got to go, like, do I have adequate mobility to get into structural balance, right? So identify what that is for you and then say, am I close enough to that? And if you're not, make that a priority. If you're close enough to that, then you can, I have this like foundational piece. And now if I want to squat, deadlift, bench press, and maybe pull up or overhead press, do I have the adequate requisite mobility to get in those positions currently? And if I don't, you need to move yourself in that direction because you have to get there. But once you're there, once you have the requisite mobility to get in those positions, you don't need any more, right? If you're trying to get, if you're trying to be a gymnast or if you're trying to be a yogi, then do more, but you just need enough to get into the positions that you need to get into. So I really enjoyed what I'll call the suffering of end range control. And yeah, and I still do. I think going into the positions of weakness, right? So the ends of the range are positions of weakness, and being like, how long can I challenge myself physically and mentally to stay in this position? I saw tremendous, now I'll say this, I saw tremendous benefits in stability and control in end range. I couldn't with 100% certainty say that I saw a direct correlation to muscle growth, but I could say I saw tremendous improvement in stability. And why I think stability is important is because the likelihood of injuries falls off, right? If I have tremendous end range control, the likelihood of getting injured is much less. I don't know that I could say that I would correlate with muscle building because I don't have any hard evidence. But if I can prevent injuries in my mind and I can train more often, heavier and longer, I correlate that with growth. So does that answer your question, man? I think you just got to see where you are right now.
Yeah.
And man, always, I'll tell you, the thing that made me different than everyone else is I was really critical of myself, and not from a perspective of putting myself down, but from a perspective of going, of being honest. And I think so many people have a hard time being honest with themselves. So my mother growing up is, my mother's a harsh person, just like very straight. Like she's very European. Like you're not getting any sugarcoating, any like beat around the bush. You're getting like straight down the midline. Right. I love that. And like, for some people, like, oh my God, that's so harsh. I'm like, that's the only way I'd like to communicate. If the whole world were like that, for me, it'd be a better place. So if you can learn to be honest with yourself and like not have to sugarcoat it, not have to be egocentric and be like, oh, I'm the best, I'm great. Like, I just am what I am. And I need to be better at this and I want to be better at that. I think you'll have a better opportunity to move in the direction of what you want. And being honest with yourself for many people is not easy.
Excellent. Yeah, that was great. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. Clears a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And so honesty, I'll say this final thing in closing is like, honesty is nuanced because it's degrees, right? And meaning standard, your standard has to play in. So if you're like, you know, my mobility here is good enough, or my mobility here is okay, or my mobility here is fucking awesome. That's pretty nuanced. Or my stability here is fucking awesome compared to, right? And like, so what is your standard? What is the standard to which you hold yourself? So I was very blessed when I was young, 17 years old, I went to Mr. Olympia and that became my standard, right? I was 155 pound kid, 17 year old kid. And looking at those Mr. Olympia competitors, the first year Ronnie Coleman won, that became my standard. So until I looked like that, I was like, I'm just keep going. And so ask yourself, what is your standard that you hold yourself to? And do you have someone that you can look up to, or some, you know, I even like the idea of like creating a standard for yourself. You know, one of the programs we're coming out with very, very soon, the foundation of it is like, what is the standard of a 35 or 40 year old or 50 year old or 60 year old man? Where should you be waist to hip ratio? Where should you be joint mobility wise? Where should you be body fat wise? Where should you be body mass wise, right? Muscle mass relative to skeletal system. Like we're trying to create a standard so that all of you guys can know, based on your bone structure, based on your age, your height, this would be a good standard for you to hold yourself to. Cause most guys don't know. Most guys will hold themselves to the standard that of the people around them or the standard of their old self, which is not necessarily good either. Right. Depending where you want to go.
Solid. Thanks, Ben.
Pleasure, brother. Anyone else have questions? Keith, I know he's got something good, man.
I had another question on breathing.
Jeff, go ahead.
So for the long exhale, I can get right around 60 seconds.
Good job.
For the inhale, it's more like 30. And I had two questions on that. And it's just, when you're starting that, are you starting on a full forced exhale or just a relaxed exhale? And then...
Just relaxed.
Okay. And then do you do anything special to train that or just do it often?
Yeah. So I don't know if it's special, but what I would do is I would spend time at, just like in training, right? Spend time at the end range. So if your inhale is the challenge, when you get to that full inhale, stay there. take a little sip of air again. Take a little sip of air again. And eventually there's no more sips to be had, but you're trying to just like, and so when you're taking those sips, the key is not to go, right? The key is, right? I want the muscles to go and relax. I want them to be flaccid. And man, it's going to take time. So every muscle contraction, every muscle length tension is orchestrated by the nervous system. So the nervous system right now is the same amount of length tension that it's probably been for the last 5 years. So if you're asking the nervous system to do this, it's not going to happen in a matter of 5 minutes. It's going to happen with repetitive exposure. So it's like, keep at it, just a little bit more, just a little bit more. And like, it's the neurotic consistency that gets you places in this world. And it has to be somewhere between obsessed and neurotic if you want to make an exceptional change. If you want to make a small change, it doesn't have to be that, right? But if you want to make an exceptional change, it has to be somewhere between obsessed and neurotic.
I can hit you with two things, Ben. One's easy one. How do you spell that? Ouija, breathing, Ouija.
I don't know.
got ya.
I'm going to look it up. Chat box.
Never would have found that. Thank you.
UJJAYI.
UJI. And then the other one, you mentioned a few times that it's kind of about the feet. And obviously try to not wear, I mean, being where I am in Australia near the beach, I don't wear shoes unless I have to. But is there other ways, apart from obviously squatting and trying to exercise as much of the gym without shoes, that we can try and get strength back into the feet? Because it feels like if that's such a fundamental issue, obviously Andrew would pick up on that from my side if there's something huge there. But is there things we can do, like you give us breathing exercises and ideas and things like that? Anything yep. like that for feet?
Yeah. So the one of the main reasons, there's a lot of reasons why I took such an attachment to yoga, not because of what yoga is at its core, not because I want to pursue the belief system behind yoga, maybe a little bit, but the big thing that I saw for myself is it was a perfect complement to bodybuilding as far as what it addresses. So bodybuilding, as I was just saying to Chris, is about end range control, right? If you can learn to control end ranges, you prevent injuries all day. And if I can prevent injuries, I'm way more effective at long-term muscle building. So long-term or end range control needs to be a consideration. So yoga puts you into these extreme end ranges and says, stay there for 5 breaths, 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out, 1 breath. So you're there 50 to 60 seconds per position. And so I like yoga for that. But the reason I'm also bringing up yoga in this case, yoga did some amazing things for my feet, because coming out of bodybuilding, I probably had, you know, like retarded, you know, Nike Jordan type shaped shoes, shaped feet. And as soon as I started taking yoga, my instructor said, hey, do this. Right. So first thing is like, can you spread your toes wide? Can you pull them back off the ground? That's kind of a yogi base. And then now stand on one foot and do different things with your leg while you're standing on one foot. And so I think the single best thing we can all do as a foundation for foot function is some basic yoga standing series poses on one foot. And so it's like, stand on one foot, put the other leg out in front at 90 degrees, right? Then take the other leg out to the side at 90 degrees. And take the leg behind you. And like, by doing all that, you're gonna notice your feet, like you're grabbing the ground. The first thing to fatigue is your feet. I mean, your hip maybe, but most of the time it's gonna be your feet. And so you're gonna notice like, holy shit, my feet are really fatigued. And if you can't stand on one foot, which is very common, it's an imbalance at your hips and a weakness at your feet. Both of the, when your feet are weak, your hips are also gonna be weak almost 100% of the time. So if you wanna improve your hip mobility, improve your foot function. So if you can't stand on one foot, it's one or the other, or probably both. So I would say start with that, start with this. And then maybe you can start doing like big toe. Can I manipulate my big toe a little bit? Can I manipulate my other fingers, just or my other toes, and just be able to do stuff like this with your toes? And then can I just stand on one foot? that's probably the single best thing you can do, and long periods of time. And it's not just like I'm standing here on my, I'm lifting one leg off the ground, like, you know, into a march position. That's too simple. But like extending your leg out in front of you and then moving your leg around. Like if I'm moving my leg through space, what does that foot have to do? Right. It has to like center itself and orient itself. And it's starting to go like this and like, oh, I'm super, I'm really starting to get stable. So I'd start with that, man. And then the next step I would add in is, well, one, barefoot shoes, two, learn how to walk, three, skipping, like skipping rope can be very good because you're landing on your foot. You turn, just don't let your heels touch down. You're turning into shock absorbers, right? So your feet are meant, the muscles are meant to absorb shock. And if they're hitting the ground consistently, they're learning to slow down their decelerative muscles.
Awesome, brother. Thank you.
My pleasure, man. Anyone else have questions before we wrap? Coach, anything you want to add? Now's your time, gents. Do we provide value for you today, guys? Do you guys get something out of this? Awesome. Well, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be a part of your journey. And I hope we can continue to be a part of your journey for a long time. And I hope we can continue to support you in the way you need to be supported. If there's something you're missing, something you want, something you need, ask, right? We may not have the answers personally, but within our community, we have an incredible network of people who probably have the answers. And I'll say in closing that your problems aren't unique. Right? The things you're going through right now, there's someone else in this community, probably a handful of people in this community going through the same things, experiencing the same challenges. We want to support you. And because we're all going through the same shit. We all have the same challenges. I have challenges. You have challenges. We're all just here to make each other better and make the world a better place in doing so. And it sounds like hyperbole, but the real reality is the better you show up for yourself, the better you show up for your family. The better you show up for your family, the better you show up for your business, your vocation. We make the world a better place. So gentlemen, I respect you. Sandy, I respect you. Thanks for being here. Guys, thank you so much and have an amazing end of your week. Talk soon.